This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So we are all increasingly living in a virtual world, especially our kids. They're on Facebook, social media. People go on eHarmony. They compare their qualities and they meet and fall in love, etc. So why not do the same thing in immunogenetics? And so the virtual cross-match is gaining a foothold because it does streamline the process and may accelerate the time to put in a kidney in patients. So our director of immunogenetics, Dr. Raj Raja, will be presenting the case for and the benefits and maybe the potential problems of the virtual cross-match.
I'm on. Thanks, Flavio. Open my slides. So this is a virtual cross match, but it is the reality of most of the cross matches that we do in the laboratory. So everyone in this room knows about the cross match. We have been doing this for years and years. It's very simple laboratory test, just taking the donor cells and mixing with the recipient and see any antibodies present in the recipient serum binds to the donor cells. So the readout will be positive cross-match or negative cross-match. Positive cross-match, don't transplant, and the negative cross-match, do the transplants. Very simple technique. But in over 50 years, people identify this very precise antibody identifications. What are the antibodies present in the serums and what are the antigens expressed on the donor? If you know this precisely, you can do it like a match cam virtually. We can do it virtual cross match. So that's what I'm going to talk. It's going to be very simple, but to get into that level, the virtual cross-match slide, I have just only one slide. Rest of the 49 slides are building the story. So I'm going to talk more about basic immunology, the system that you have, everyone has it, and you are using it for every day, every time, and fighting against infections. So these are the objectives of my talk. In the end of my talk, I hope you will understand the basic of histocompatibility systems and various HLA antibody testing methods, various cross-match techniques, and ultimately what's the concept and utility of virtual cross-match. So if a recipient receive an allograft, without any immunosuppression, they will reject. So the system, the genes, proteins, the factors that involves in this rejection process, we call it histocompatibility systems. It has three major components. We know this. So the blood group systems, which is very simple, ABO group. Then the major histocompatibility systems, which are HLA molecules. And the last one is the minor histocompatibility system, which is any amino acid difference between two different individuals. But you can characterize all these three systems into two factors. So all three are polymorphics, very different between individuals. And they are immunogenic. They can trigger immune response. But the strength of the amount of polymorphism and the strength of immunogenicity is variable. For example, the blood group antigens, there are very few variations, only four different blood group antigens. But it's very high immunogenic. You don't want to cross this ABO barrier. But the minor histocompatibility complex, as I mentioned, any single amino acid difference between two individuals are considered to be the minor histocompatibility antigens, but most of them are not making any immune response. That less in terms of immune response, they are very low. Only around 20-25 distinct minor histocompatibility antigens have been characterized that is known to elicit immune response. But the major histocompatibility antigens that are HLA, that in terms of polymorphism, they are highly polymorphic as well as highly immunogenic. That's the big barrier that, that we are trying to overcome. Because these HLA molecules are the one, the HLA molecules are the one present the foreign peptides, the viral peptides to our immune systems. See, every single cells in our body express HLA class 1 molecules. So if the cell, if you get infection, so I'm hitting the wrong button. Okay, so if you get the infection, the infectious materials or the viral proteins is loaded in the context of our self HLA class 1, which is present ultimately to the subset of T lymphocytes. It's called CD8 positive T lymphocytes, which we have a majority of T cells in our bloodstream are this type. So once the T cell recognize the class 1 molecules with this foreign peptides, it triggers the immune response. Basically, it releases all the cytolytic molecules that kills these infected target cells. So you contain the infection. So if the infection is not contained by this mechanism, so then a subset of new cells come into place. These cells are called professional antigen-presenting cells, so like dendritic cells, monocytes, macrophage, and B cells, and so on. Their primary function is just capturing these all antigens and presenting to our another subset of immune cells. So to perform the special antigen-presenting functions, they express a special HLA molecules. They're called class 2 molecules. So class 2 molecules are expressed on a subset of immune cells, antigen-presenting cells. But the class 1 is expressed on almost every single cell in our body systems. So once the foreign peptide is presented in the context of class 2 molecules, it is presented to another subset of T cells called T helper cells, which basically secretes interleukin-2, which are the basically growth factors that can act upon the T cells and the B cells. So it can trigger more cells which are specific to this invading pathogen that is mounted on the class 1, class 2 molecule. So you can trigger immune response. You can contain the immune response. So if you, in the whole slide, so the one important factor, that is HLA molecules, HLA class 1, class 2, those are the one control your immune response. If you don't have HLA molecules, you will die by infection. So now we are living with many viruses and bacteria. So to present all this variety of pathogens, just one HLA molecule is not good enough. That's why we have many HLA molecules. We have at least 15 HLA molecules, we have it. And those genes are present in this particular chromosome 6. And the gene complex is known major histocompatibility complex. This is the most gene-dense region ever identified in humans. It spans around 4 megabases of DNA. It contains 124 genes, and 50% of them are expressed, and 50 genes have some immune function, not necessarily HLA molecules, but it also trigger other proteins like interferon gamma, complement factors, and all involves in the immune functions. And physically, this HLA or MSC region can be divided into three regions. Towards the one telomeric region is the class 1 regions. Towards the centromeric region is class 2 region. In between these two are the class 3 regions. So in the next slides, I'm going to make it in a very simple picture of the same slide. So these are the class 1 regions and class 2 region and class 3 regions. So in class 1 regions, we have three genes, HLA A, B, and C. And class 2 region, we have three sets of genes, DR gene, and DQ gene, and DP gene. So the DR genes, in each in the set, we have one gene, A gene, and other one is B gene. So the A gene is the one encoding alpha chain, and the B gene encodes beta gene. These together combine and express in one DR molecule. So you have one DR, one DQ, and one DP. It's coming from alpha chain and beta chain. And all these genes are polymorphic. So the number, except one gene, the DRA genes, which has only two variants. And the number I put underneath each gene indicates the number of different variants identified in population. So the B, HLA-B, is very highly polymorphic. Over 2,459 different HLA-B molecules identified in human populations. So you will have either one or two out of these 2,500 different variety of HLA-B molecules. So now we have two chromosomes, one from father and one from mother. So we look at the gene content, it's not always same. And particularly in the DR regions, you have additional genes. Some haplotypes having additional DRB genes. Either it could be DRB3 or DRB4 or DRB5. So it is even the gene content can be different because it, out of four haplotypes, you will have two of any of these two combinations. So in terms of genes, one can differentiate. Then what I'm going to show you here is this is two different individuals. The individual one here in the bottom having simple genotype. There is only one DR gene, but the individual on the top having four different DRB genes. So what happens if you consider if all the genes are polymorphics, then you will have in the bottom ones, the B locus, you have the same allelic polymorphism, B27, CW7, everything same. So in this case, you will express only one B molecules, one C, one A, and the combination here from the alpha chain, beta chain, express one DR, one DQ, and one DP. But if you look at on the top, the second individuals, you have polymorphism in every single genes. So in the B locus, you have B7 and B44, and similarly, every C locus, you have two different alleles. So in this case, you will express two different B molecules, 2C and 2A. Okay, so that's a huge difference. One individual having only three HLA class 1 molecules, other individual can have six different HLA molecules. And if you look at the DR, the combination of these two genes can produce one protein. Combination of these two genes can produce another protein. And you have here and here one protein, another one. So there is a four possible DR one can express versus just one DR by one person. There will be a huge diversity. Some individual can express only two proteins, some individual three proteins, and so on. And if you look at the DQ, the both genes are polymorphic, not like the DR, the both genes are polymorphic. So that the combination of these two one protein and this two one protein and the trans, the combination of the top gene, the DRB, DQB one here, and this gene can make one protein, another one. So you will have another four DQ molecules. Similarly, the DP, A and B are polymorphics, then you will end up with expressing four different proteins. So just looking at the number, one individual can express 18 different HLA molecules, but another individual can express just only six HLA molecules. And this is the diversity in HLA systems. This kind of diversity, extensive diversity, can be seen within the families. One child can have only six HLA molecules, the other one can have 18 different HLA molecules. So what it tells, going back to my original slide, the biology of HLA is presenting antigens. So that indicates clearly this individual having more HLA are advantages, having presenting a variety of pathogenic peptides to the immune system when you compare with the individuals having a limited HLA phenotypes. But the problem is in transplantation, finding an HLA matched transplantation is very hard. So what I've shown here is different varieties of HLA matching algorithms. So the top one, see here in this combination, so these are the recipient HLA types. So for simplicity, I just show A, B, and DRs. You have two A's, two B, and two DRs. The donor type is same, so we call them HLA identical. But if you look at here in the bottom, the recipient donor types are entirely different. So the organ has one HLA type and the recipient has different HLA type. So if the organ gets infected, so there is no biology of antigen presentations. So there is a different varieties of that can be one mismatch or haploidentical and so on. So I'm not going to talk about these mismatches, but the better mismatches are the better outcomes. So the worst mismatches are the worst outcome. So in transplantation scenarios, if the kidney express this set of HLA molecules, if the recipient also have the same HLA, there's not much problem, no alloreactivity. But there is a difference. For example, this molecule, the HLA-B27, is different in the donor. Then all the immune cells will be targeting here. So the T cells, CD8 T cells, will recognize and trigger cytolytic activity. And the B cells will recognize this difference and triggers antibody production. And the CD4 T cells, if there is an additional class 2 mismatches, it recognizes and triggers growth factors for the T cells as well as the B cells. So you will enhance all the immune responses against all the mismatched HLA antigens. So now still the transplantation can be done because if you remove all these cells, the immune cells, you can put your kidney. So that's what we are doing. So the induction therapy, that basically eliminates all the immune cells. But still the problem is the antibodies. There's no drugs. All these drugs are resistant to the antibodies or antibody-producing plasma cells, which is hidden in the bone marrow. So we end up with having problem with these antibodies. Antibodies are very bad because basically, the people having transplantation produce antibodies. The people having multiple pregnancies are producing antibodies, and the transfusions, infection, vaccination also can trigger HLA antibodies. And the antibodies can react in many different ways. It can fix the complement, kill the organs. It's kind of adapted that connects both innate and adaptive immunity. And it has a lot of consequences. It can goes from the hyperacute rejection to the chronic rejections, and it can also eliminate transplantation. If the patient is highly sensitized, it is very hard to find a suitable donor. So to Paul Terasaki in 50 years back, he developed a very simple test. That's the cross match. Still, people are using it in the laboratory. It is just mixing the lymphocytes from the donor and serum from the recipient and see whether any antibodies in the recipient is binding to the donor cells. So if there is no antibodies in the serum, recipient serum, so nothing binding to the donor cells, if there is an HLA antibody that binds, then he has the complement that kills the cells so that if you add the dye, so you can distinguish the dead cells and the live cells. So the dead cells means you have the antibody in the serum against a particular HLA molecules. So you don't want to transplant here. And here's that live cells means there's no antibodies, so one can do the transplantations. So this is very simple method that he developed in 1960s. Then he also published this paper. So he looked at 30 positive cross matches. 24 out of 30 are showing hyperacute and accelerated rejection. And most of the negative cross-match individuals, the graft function was fine. So since this publication, it becomes the standard of care for the transplantation. But the problem here is these two numbers. So but still, the cross-match is used as the clinical testing, but it's not too sensitive or not too specific. There are some false positive and false negative reactions. So people try to eliminate this false positive and false negative reaction by simply modifying the test procedures. They can eliminate. So if you look at the cells, the cells are not only expressing HLA molecules. They express other junk of proteins. And the same way, the recipient serum not only having HLA antibodies, but it also have other antibodies, including IgM antibodies. So the IgM antibodies can kill the cells. It can because it can fix the complement, but it is not clinically relevant. So people using this chemical, the DTT, one can deplete all these IgM antibodies, or they can add anti-human globulin to enhance the sensitivity of the cross-match testing. But still, it is not good enough. Still, there is a lot of false positive and false reactive reactions. So then people develop the flow cytometry cross-match, which is 30% more sensitive than the classical CDC cross-matches. So it's the same technique. So you have the donor cells, then you add the serum, mix with them, if the serum has HLA antibodies that binds to the donor-specific cells, then you add, instead of complement, you add the secondary antibody that is specific to HLA, the IgG antibodies. The secondary antibodies has fluorochrome, which can be detected by the flow cytometry. So the more antibodies it binds, the stain will be high. So you can detect in the flow cytometry, and that goes, the reading will be read by like this. Then when you compare with the negative control serum, which do not have any antibodies, then detecting this negative control serum, pick with this positive or the patient serum, you can come up with a number, how much the median channel is sifting for the T cells and B cells. So that gives a value of a channel sifts, a quantitative readout for the positive cross matches. So it's not going to tell just positive and negative, but you can also see in terms of number how much positive. Then because the secondary antibodies are very specific to the IgG molecules, they don't recognize IgM molecules. It's very, very specific to the IgG molecules. And also adding the pronase, one can deplete all the background. So you get very specific cross matches. But still, there are a lot of false positive and false negative cross matches. So 8% of the flow cross matches are false positives. So that means you will avoid unnecessary transplantation unnecessarily. Then 7% of the flow cross matches are false negative. That means if you have the DSA, it's not going to detect in the cross match. So still we need to have very refined cross matches. So that's what the virtual cross match come into play. So there are two things needs to be done for the virtual cross match. If you know what are the antigens expressed on the donor sites, if you define all clearly, everything, all 12 different HLA genes, some of them are, sometimes you may need to define at the allelic levels. Then in recipients, if you characterize all the antibodies using single antigen beta, which I'm come to later, so if you define these components from the donor side and recipient side, you can predict what are the antibodies you have it in the patients and is that antibodies are against the donor's antigens. And how much antibodies, if you know that number, you can predict how pretty much whether it's going to cause the CDC cross-match or the flow cross-match, or it's going to be a negative cross-match. So there are many methods we have been using it to define the HLA antigens and antibodies. This is the Luminex technology. This is the mainstay of our laboratory. We have been using for last 10 years. So this technology uses polystyrene microbeads. We don't do this anything. So we just buy it from the commercial companies. So basically, they color them using two different fluorescents, yellow and red fluorescent, with a different proportions, so that individual beads, these 100 beads, can have a unique colors. So the flow cytometry can distinguish those beads. Then you take the beads and conjugate with a unique HLA protein. So each bead has a specific HLA molecules. Then we pull all these 100 beads, which has 100 different HLA molecules into a single tubes. So this is what we buy from the commercial products. Then once we get the patient serum, you isolate the serum and mix with these beads, the same way that we do for the cross matches. Then if the patient serum has any antibodies, for in this case A2, that binds to this particular bead. Then you add the secondary antibody, which has a fluorochrome. Then you can detect using the Luminex methods, which has two lasers. One detects the population of the cell base or the beads. Other one detects the secondary antibodies. So again, it's a very simple test, but it's very specific test. So if you run the negative control serums, it looks like this. So you have different 100 beads. Each bead is coded with a different unique HLA proteins. Then in the x-axis, it gives the fluorochrome, the MFI values. So that gives how much antibody it binds. So if you look at this is the patient serum showing some antibodies here. There are six or eight different antibodies. You can see it's over 20,000 MFI. And if you look at all these antibodies, you can see there are different antibodies, but in reality, there's only one antibody here. So there are five different antibodies, And the frequency of these antibodies or the target for these antigens are 62%. So that means if the patient having this profile will avoid 62% of the UNOS donors. And they are basically one antibody. I'm going to explain in a couple of slides next. So if you look at all the HLA molecules, they are very, very similar. So the differences are very, very, very little. So each HLA molecule has their own unique epitope. So epitope is nothing but the one recognized by the antibodies. So each HLA molecule here has unique epitopes, which are recognized by an HLA antibodies. Then in addition to this unique epitope, the HLA also has a public epitopes. For example, here, this triangle is present in all these five HLA molecules. So if an antibody is developed against these triangles, that particular antibody can react with all these HLA molecules, okay? So for example, if a person getting a kidney, so this is HLA type, the allograft HLA type, and the recipient HLA type, the mismatch antigen is only one antigen, that is HLA-A2, then we will think he will develop only A2 antibodies, but actually he's developing more antibodies because of the shared epitopes. So the antibodies, it's not like one HLA molecule and one HLA antibodies. You have one HLA molecules and multiple HLA antibodies, and the same antibodies can bind to different HLA molecules. So we call them as a cross-reactive group. So there are 11 different cross-reactive groups has been identified. So it's always, when you have the patient's antibodies, never been just single antibodies. You have a bunch of antibodies. And some of these cross-reactive groups are very, the frequency is very high. So it is present in multiple or majority of the HLA type, particularly the BW4 and BW6. So they are present in one-third of the HLA B molecules. For example, this patient, so you can see one-third of all the HLA class 1 molecules are reacting. So basically, this is only one HLA antibody, so that is BW4 antibody. So the antibody binds to that particular epitope shared by all these HLA proteins. So the calculated PRA would be 61%. So if the patient, this kind of antibodies, he need to avoid 61% of the UNOS donors. So the BW6 is another epitope, very broadly present epitopes, which avoids 80% of the donors in the unit. Some individuals can have two epitopes or two cross-reactive groups or multiple cross-reactive groups. So these are some unique cases. So for example, if the woman having BW4 genotype and her husband was BW6, then by multiple pregnancies, she will develop antibodies against this particular epitope, BW6. Then that means she will develop many antibodies, then she will avoid 85% of the UNOS donors. So again, this is one single antibodies, but binding to multiple HLA class 1 molecules. So the problem is most of the time we cannot even detect these antibodies. So you can see all this clumping into this one corner, but the MFI values are less than 1,000, very weak MFIs. So most of the time we don't even call these antibodies, but they are in the bloodstream, so it can trigger the memory response. So the cells that are the plasma cells that making antibodies are in the body. So we don't even call this antibody, but now we are realizing we should call this even the weak antibodies less than 1,000 MFI. But some individuals can have antibodies to almost everything except their own molecules. So what I'm showing here is just only the class 1 antibodies. If you see the class 2 antibodies, so majority or 30% of the waitlist population having or sensitized, having some level of antibodies. So in addition to that, there are some allele-specific antibodies. You have one A2 molecules, but not there are 200 different varieties of allelic polymorphism of A2. So the people can develop antibodies to a particular HLA A2 types. So you need to distinguish those antibodies also. That's another level of complexity. So if you look at our wait list, So over 11% of the individuals in the kidney wait list having 80% over 80%. It's a huge problem. It's not so the high PRA is not very random. It's so over 600 people having 80% PRA, and most of them are retransplant or the woman. So what is the outcome of this all this antibody testing? So once we have the antibody testings, we will list all the unacceptable antigens in the units. Just you can just click all this button. If you have, say, two antibodies with the patients, you click them, that will avoid any UNOS donor having HLA-A2 antigens. So that's what you can do it in the laboratory. So for example, if the patient has a A2, so these are the donor types here. So if they have A2, so all you have to look at how many individuals carrying the HLA-A2 molecules. So in this panel, there are 47% of this panel carrying HLA-A2 targets. So you need to avoid this, all these 47% of the individuals. If the patient has additional antibodies like DR4, then you will be avoiding more donors. So that's going to be 60% of the donors. So if he has additional antibodies like a DQ5, you'll be avoiding more donors. That's going to be 69% of the donors. So the more antibodies the patient carrying, so you will avoid a lot of UNOS donors. So they're getting a matched donor is very unlikely. So we also did a correlation between the MFI, the strength of antibodies, and the cross-matches. So this is the flow cross-match, T cell cross-match, and the MFIs. So if anything over 5,000 MFI, the flow cross-match will be positive. And anything over 15,000 MFI, the CDC cross-match will be positive. So in UCSF, we block anything over 2,000 MFIs. So that means you never get any positive cross-match, even with this sensitive flow cytometry. But the problem is there are some allele-specific antibodies, and there are some I think I have this slide. So if the patient has this unique antibodies like a DP, DP alpha, DQ alphas, and allele-specific antibodies, the UNOS has no option to block it. So we cannot block those antigens, so we will be getting the positive cross-match. And on the top, we are always looking at the antibodies in the patients and donor typing in the donors. We never look at the expression of the donor types. So the physical cross match is the only way that is donor specific. So that's still, it is a very valid cross match because the HLA proteins, the expression can be different by donor to donors. It is not very well characterized, but at least some locus, like such as like HLA-CW, is known to be low expressed alleles when you compare with other B and A molecules. And some alleles, like B44, the expression can be very low when you compare with other HLA-B molecules. So it can be an allele-specific expression also. In addition to that, other cytokines can induce the class 1 and class 2 expression. So it is important to have the donor-specific cross-matches done. And moreover, in the solid phase assay that we are using, the single antigen-based assay, it has one problem because all this single antigen has been synthesized using, majority of them are using insect cell lines. So it is not comparable to the native proteins. So the antibody can bind to the conformational epitopes like here. So when the synthetic proteins are processed and conjugated on the beads, this conformational epitope can change. So that's why you need to have the physical cross-match also done. So that will be more appropriate. So this is the protocol that we used in UCSF. So you see, if the patient has no antibodies, we don't enter any awards in the unit. So it can be done virtual cross-match. If the patient has antibodies, particularly with this unstable antibodies, you know, we screen multiple times, it goes up and down, then we want to put in this category. So then if the patient have the DP antibodies, DQ alpha, DQ beta, or allele-specific antibodies, too many antibodies, then we will avoid only those with over 2,000 MFI, and we will follow with do the flow cytometry cross-match. And if the patient antibodies are well-defined and are stable, then we will avoid all antibodies. Anything over 1,000 MFI, then we'll go for the virtual cross-match. So this is not only the practice in UCSF, but many other centers also using the virtual cross-match and very successful. So these are the advantages. It has precision to our the actual cross match, and it eliminates the physical cross match. So that means you save a lot of money and workload from the laboratory as well as the OPO. And there's no samples involved, so you don't need to wait for the samples from the donor, and you don't need to do the cross match in the middle of the night. Then it improves allocations, and it increases the rate of transplantation, particularly in the sensitized people. And it permits a national paradigm change. And also, one can count the risk of memory response. If you know what is the memory mismatches from the previous transplant, you can avoid those antigens also. So in comparison to this, the virtual cross-match is very powerful technique. So if you define the antibodies and antigens in your precise manner, you can predict your cross-match very well. So I think I'll stop here, then I'll take any questions. Thank you. Yes, Dr. Yossi.
I had a question of why the beads actually ever work. You know, the polymorphism between HLA molecules really resides in the peptide binding group, and the differences between one allele versus another really affect the motifs of the peptide that's being bound. And you referred to it really quickly that these single antigen beads are made in insect cells.
Most of them.
Most. So the issue is that, is it because we're so conserved compared to insects that most of the cell peptides that are, because in your picture, you didn't draw the peptide. You just drew empty class 1 and class 2. But there are human-specific peptides and even tissue-specific peptides that may be in there that you're not picking up with the single antigen beads. So I can see why there might be a disconnect. It seems like a small number, but there could be a disconnect completely between the single antigen antibody testing and an actual cross-match where you're using actual cells that actually really truly express that stable trimolecular complex between either alpha chain, heavy chain, beta 2 microglobulin, and the antigenic peptide. Can you address why it actually works? What are most of the peptides exactly the same between the insect cells or whatever peptide being loaded on?
No. As you indicated, is that the peptide doesn't affect the antibody binding. The most of the epitopes recognized by the antibodies are in the peptide binding group as well as outside the binding groups. It's not deeply buried. So there are some polymorphism that is recognized by the T cell epitopes as well as around the antigen binding group. So most of the antibodies are hitting those regions. And some of the public epitope, the BW4 and BW6, they are deeply buried in the inside the pocket, but it's in the corner, in the C terminal end of the pocket. So still the antibody can access. If you look at the antibody, so they are the complement, or not complements, the loops are the one recognizing those antibodies. So there are two, there's a publication test, they take two HLA molecules, B molecule, B44O2 and B44O3, they are naturally occurring alleles. They differ by a single amino acids, but the polymorphism sitting in the binding group, but you can see the difference in the single antigen binding. So it's still, yes, but when you make the antibodies, still the biology is not clear. But so far, there's a correlation. That's it. So there are a lot of differences in terms of the antibody binding. So that's why people still argue the physical cross-match is necessary. I mean, it's still not very studied. Like the DP antibody, you can see 20,000 MFI. It never binds to the cells. But sometimes at 2,000 MFI, it gives a positive cross-match. So they probably have the more autoantibodies, so not necessarily directed to the HLA molecules. So they are clinically insignificant, but it can affect our testings. So what we do, we clean up all the cells using the Pro-Niz that chop down all the Fc receptors that non-specifically bind antibodies. So that clean up a lot of false positive cross match. We do see the B cell cross match is positive, but when you do the Pro-Niz, it become negative. Okay, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.